Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ted McDonald. I am with the Center for Health Policy of Boise State University, and I'm going to be talking to you today about what we perceive to be the disturbing prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems among juveniles in detention. And this should be kind of interesting because our results can be contrasted against the, some of the findings from the first two presentations. Linda Osgood and Emily Van Ness, they're not here today, but made very meaningful contributions to this presentation. So the purpose of this project was really to evaluate the data on mental health and substance abuse problems among juveniles that are detained in 12 juvenile detention centers that exist in Idaho. And two of those are essentially juvenile prisons, but the remaining 10 are along the lines of a juvenile hall, sort of a setup for less serious kinds of offenders. And the primary purpose of this project was to determine the overall prevalence. I think all of us are interested in just how prevalent are mental health and substance abuse problems in youth, and that really was what we were looking at. Now, we were also interested in looking at the possibility of gender differences, and some gender differences were discussed in the last presentation. We'll touch on that there. But we were also particularly interested in looking at what are some of the most common types of mental health and substance abuse problems, because that's pretty important for trying to target intervention and treatment efforts and that sort of thing. So this study was conducted for the Idaho Department of Juvenile Corrections, which provides oversight to all of the county detention centers throughout the state. Now, the background on this is somewhat similar to that presented by the other presenters that have come up so far. Mental health and substance abuse problems are reported to be highly prevalent among individuals in incarcerated populations. That's true of adults and of juveniles, but kind of frustratingly, the estimates vary really widely. And there are probably a number of reasons for that. Some of the studies have been done in county jails or city jails where the prevalence has a tendency to be somewhat lower. There have been other studies that are done actually in prisons where the prevalence is often somewhat higher. But it's a little vexing to try to make an overall conclusion about the prevalence of these problems when they vary so much. Some of the, you know, some studies have reported single digit prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems. Others have reported up to 90%. So it's difficult to know what exactly to do. But sometimes I think these projects are a little bit flawed due to inconsistent methodology. A lot of different types of testing methods are used. There were several different scales that have been used in the projects that we've discussed so far in this particular presentation. There's less research out there on the prevalence of mental health and substance abuse problems in juveniles relative to adults, but there are some pretty good studies out there that are relatively recent. And I've listed three here. And who actually did these probably is not so much important as the numbers that you see. They certainly cluster around a certain area of between two-thirds to about three-quarters of individuals having mental health or substance abuse problems. And there are different scales that were used in these. They have been conducted in different states and so forth. But you definitely see there's some commonality in the reports of the numbers. And it'll be interesting to see how those kind of jive with what we found in the detention centers in Idaho. Up until relatively recently, Idaho was one of relatively few states that did not have on-site, usually full-time, mental health and substance abuse clinicians in juvenile detention centers, which is pretty sad, really. But Idaho is a pretty low tax-based state. A lot of our public health services are pretty badly underfunded, and I think that's one of the reasons why we didn't have individuals. But a small grant was gained by the Department of Juvenile Corrections in late 2006, and a pilot project was put together in one of the juvenile detention centers to have a full-time mental health and juvenile, mental health and substance abuse clinician, so when youngsters came in, they could be screened right off the bat to see if they had mental health or substance abuse problems. That could guide what sort of treatment they might get while they're in the facility, and it might have some good implications for what do you do with these kids when they go back to the community, trying to link them up with community-based services and so forth. So this that pilot study was just one site, But the results suggested that mental health and substance abuse problems were prevalent enough, this is a serious enough problem, that a larger grant was gained to fund having mental health and substance abuse clinicians in the other 11 juvenile detention centers in the state. So what is essentially being done in this project? This is an ongoing project, thankfully, on the basis of what we found in this original study. There have been some more efforts to fund subsequent years, but this is all on the first year here. So when individuals come in to the system in Idaho juvenile detention centers, there is some screening information that is gathered, demographic information, including gender, booking charges using the uniform crime reporting categories. We have the children asked whether or not they've been previously diagnosed with a mental health or substance abuse problem, which I think has some interesting implications for the results that we'll find later. They're also screened using a test called the Alaska Screening Test, or the Alaska Screening Tool, it's sometimes referred to. This is not the most common measure that's used for juveniles. The MACE-2 instrument is more often used, but the clinician in the pilot study found that this one appeared to be the most valid, the most difficult for youngsters to kind of manipulate their responses to, and that sort of thing. And then also, it was tracked whether or not a so-called provisional diagnosis was made, and if so, what that diagnosis was. And the provisional diagnosis was based on the AST scores and also a short structured interview that the clinicians did with the juveniles. Data were collected on a large group of young individuals. Over 2,000 individuals had data collected on them in one of the 12 detention centers. Slightly over 70% were boys. The juveniles that are in our data set were detained in 11 facilities. One of the facilities only had one youngster come through it the entire year, and you can't really include one youngster and then report on that person because it's really obvious who he or she was and confidentiality problems. But anyways, over 75% of those juveniles were in the five largest urban facilities in the state, two of which were the juvenile prisons. Now, 60% of the individuals, when they were asked whether or not they'd been previously diagnosed with a mental health or a substance abuse problem, reported that they had, which is kind of interesting when you think of that in terms of primary prevention and trying to keep people out of the system in the future. I'll return to that point in just a second. But the booking charges were recorded on nearly 97% of the individuals. And the most booking charges are the most common booking charges. The reason that I chose to include these here is that the largest group, 54%, were essentially repeat offenders. They were individuals that were coming back through the system, and we knew that because the bulk of them, the booking charge was essentially a probation violation. So you could tell that they had been in the system before. But other individuals, probably first-timers, drug crimes, a little less than 25%, property crimes, over 1 in 5, crimes against persons, and so forth down the line. Now, here are really the most interesting results. These two bars right here are for the overall population, and essentially what we found is that 68% of the youngsters met the criteria of the Alaska Screening Tool criteria for having a mental health problem. That's over two-thirds, right? We also found that about 54% met the Alaska Screening Tool criteria for having a substance abuse problem. When you break that down and you look at males and females, you see the same pattern there. Clearly, there isn't an interaction, but there was a significant main effect for gender, such that girls were significantly more often diagnosed with a mental health problem than boys. And of course, a lot of us are familiar with the mental health literature. Women are more often diagnosed than men. That may not necessarily mean that more women suffer than men. They might be more forthcoming about the symptom patterns and that sort of thing. But anyways, we did find that main effect there. There was not a main effect when it came to the substance abuse problems. Boys had or were diagnosed with those somewhat more than girls, but it wasn't large enough to be statistically significant. Now, this breaks down all of the categories to see those that were diagnosed with neither a mental health or substance abuse problem, just a mental health problem, just a substance abuse problem, or both. And what you see here, it's not a majority, it's only about 41%, but it clearly is a plurality of the individuals were diagnosed with both a mental health and a substance abuse problem. And those of us that are familiar with mental health treatment and that sort of thing know that that's pretty problematic. Dual diagnosis, comorbidities, when individuals have more than one sort of problem, it gets increasingly difficult to provide care and really to help those individuals. So I think that's a very worrisome finding, at least with respect to the kids in the juvenile justice system in Idaho. The provisional diagnoses that were given, the AST didn't specify, I'm sorry, I'm making this hard for you to see, don't specify really what the problem is, but then the structured interview can kind of tease that out afterwards. The most common class of disorders were mood disorders, of which major depression was clearly the most common of those. Substance abuse disorders were also very common. The disruptive behavior disorders, you see that a lot in incarcerated populations with conduct disorder or oppositional defiant disorder, so forth. Anxiety disorders seemed relatively few given their overall prevalence in the population, but also there were attention deficit disorders that came up quite often. And those were usually comorbid with something else. So what we can conclude from this is that mental health and substance abuse problems appear to be extremely prevalent among the juveniles that came in the system. If you sort of collapse together some of the data that we looked at earlier for mental health only, substance abuse only, or both, what we conclude is that over 83% of these kids had one problem, the other, or both. That's significantly higher, well, I shouldn't say significantly because that implies a statistical sort of comparison. But the gentleman that just presented that data in Taiwan, it was in the 40s. I think it was about 43%. This is very, very different. And it could be a cultural difference, it could be a measurement difference, but I think there's something interesting to consider there. Comorbid mental health and substance abuse problems at least appear to be the norm. They're the plurality. So as a treatment provider in these juvenile detention facilities, when you see a person for the first time, you almost should expect that they have, well, certainly that they have some sort of problem, but the most likely pattern is that they actually have both a mental health and a substance abuse problem. And also, most of these juveniles that we found to have mental health or substance abuse problems had been previously diagnosed. That was 60%. So someone knew they had these problems when they were out there in the community, but they may not have been addressed, and lo and behold, here you have people ending up in the juvenile correction system. So the kind of final conclusions here, it would really make a good deal of sense to try to connect people that have been diagnosed either by a school counselor, a doctor, whatever, with some mental health or substance abuse treatment in the community in the hopes that they never end up in the system in the first place, because a lot of us know how cyclical that system is. You get in there, start coming back, next thing you know, you're in the adult incarceration population, and things just kind of go downhill from there. So also, there should be age-appropriate mental health and substance abuse services that are available to kids once they get into those detention facilities, because if you don't treat them, they're going to come right out of that facility back into the community, maybe worse off than they were before. And that's obviously highly problematic. And lastly, connecting diagnosed detained juveniles with services upon their release may really reduce the likelihood that they recidivate in the future and that they come back into the system at a later date. Thank you.